Okay, warriors, you are listening to Unqualified Therapists. Remember, stay wild and weird.
Hey, warriors, this is Amy.
And I'm Sarah. We started this podcast because mental health is complicated and the stigma surrounding it can make us feel alone.
So we are here to share authentic stories in order to normalize and prioritize mental health.
We believe in professional therapy. We both use it on our own healing journeys.
But we also know it isn't one size fits all. So we are here to provide tools from our own experiences,
as well as those from our guests and professionals that come on the show.
Thank you for being here as we navigate the complexities of mental health and mental illness together.
Remember, hold on, warriors. We're gonna make it. Warrior.
Welcome back, everyone, to another episode of The Unqualified Therapist.
We are back in our virtual studio, which we always is. It's fun. So buckle up, folks, because you never know what can happen when we're in the virtual studio. But we're having a great conversation this week. We don't talk about it enough, but November is Men's Mental Health Awareness Month. It goes by Movember. And so it just was by happenstance, though, that this gentleman that we met probably, was it 6 months ago or so, in April-ish, on the Jagoff podcast. He was another guest with his daughter there with their band, The Altered Egos. And it was we had such a lovely conversation afterwards. And we had such a great connection and understanding for one another and for what we were going through and what we stood for within mental health and that space, and the connection of music, because all of us just love music so much. So we are so happy to have Eric Hodos on with us today. Thank you so much for coming on.
Oh, happy to be here. Thank you. Yeah.
If you want to just kind of tell us a little bit about yourself, maybe your story of how mental health has been, or mental illness or therapy or all of those things have impacted you in your life, and kind of what you want to tell us about your story.
Yeah, I think the thing is I never realized the impact of mental health until probably the last 18 months or so. And it was really pretty profound and eye opening. And, you know, like, I mean, I'm a child of the 70s and 80s and, you know, and all the, you know, kind of the I'll say stigma, like around certain aspects of health. So I grew up in Pittsburgh. I grew up in Aetna in the, you know, 70s, 80s, to a young parents. My parents were like 19 and 20 when I was born. My dad was 20. My mom was 19. My father, who's passed away, was very abusive to my mother, myself. I grew up on a street that, you know, it's not bad, like in the way that you see certain things that are bad, but it was, you know, a lot of bullies, a lot of just, I mean, every day, like from the grade school through junior high school, you either ran or you fought, you know, and it was just the way it was. My brothers were 2.5 and 3.5 years, or are 2.5, 3.5 years younger than me, respectively. We're bigger kids. I was like the nerd with glasses and braces that wanted to read books and collect bugs and all that. And, you know, and play with toy soldiers and stuff like that. My dad had other plans for me. He wanted me to be like a, you know, like a sports person, and, you know, really kind of pushed me hard and was very physically and mentally, emotionally abusive to my mother and me, especially. And there was some trickle down effect to my brothers, but because I was the oldest and the weakest and didn't kind of live up to what he had expected from, you know, a child of his, I took a lot of the brunt of it. So as a kid growing up, there was never any really safe space for me. My mother would try, but, you know, she had her own struggles, and she's one of the most resilient and tough women that I know, and we have a phenomenal relationship. They got divorced when I was, you know, in, you know, probably just starting high school, junior high. And, you know, I actually kind of celebrated the fact that they were getting divorced because it would get the, my old man out of the house, but he'd come back and it would just get worse. And then, you know, he kind of worked us over to where we went and lived with him over time because, you know, he was a very controlling and narcissistic personality. So, you know, I grew up kind of as a failure in his eyes, like school. I mean, I never realized it, but I have like off the charts ADHD, you know. And I read books, taught myself chess, like second grade, as soon as I could read. But I had no interest in, you know, what was going on in school, really, you know, other than like I would read history books. I would do all kind of like crosswords, puzzles, all that sort of thing. But I got older and, you know, I realized that I was tired of getting, you know, beat up on and all that. So I started, you know, really kind of working out, boxing, things like that, which was kind of against where I was as a kid. But out of necessity, and I realized it was easier to take a beating, you know, and fight back because you became less of a hard target. You became a harder target. And so that worked. And then I found out that, you know, the more in shape I got, the tougher I got, you know, that I could take care of that. We had no way of like really paying for school. I really didn't want to go to school. I wanted to join the Army. So I did a compromise with my parents and I joined the Army National Guard at 17. Went to boot camp and all my friends were going to college. That kind of got my mind right and put me, I won't say mind right, it gave me motivation to not want to live in institutionalized living, be it in the Army, be it in jail or wherever. And I came back, you know, because it's part-time, right? You go and you do like your basic training and your advanced training and then you go to college. Went to college, did really well, community college, because I wasn't getting accepted anywhere else. And then later, after things really kind of hit the fan at home with my dad, and, you know, it got very physically abusive because now I was the primary target that, and, you know, he'd kind of taken all my savings from me, joint bank account, that sort of thing. So I was left with no other option other than to go out to live with my mother. And it was like, I literally, like, you know, was standing in a street corner with whatever I could grab, and my aunt came and picked me up. Like, we weren't allowed to see the other side of the family. We weren't allowed to have friends that weren't, you know, we weren't really allowed to have any outside contact. I mean, having a girlfriend or anything like that in high school was pretty much impossible. It was just a very controlling area. So I went into the Army, went through some difficult schools in the Army, got an ROTC scholarship, became an Army officer, and then that kind of got me, you know, on the right track. But I always suffered from, I always had like that sense of foreboding and fear, and like they were going to figure out that, you know, I was a fraud, or they were going to figure out that I wasn't good enough. And so I would overcome that by doing the hardest things I could in the Army, by running marathons competitively, and just, you know, throwing myself a good physical thrashing just to see how tough I was. And that kind of took care of things for a while. But I always had to find that rush, and it wasn't through drugs or alcohol. It was just, I'm going to go out and do whatever I can to see how tough I am, to see if I rate, to see if I can stick it out. And, you know, that worked well. It gave me a lot of motivation at work. A lot of people, if I had a nickel for every time somebody said, oh boy, that guy's really intense, I'd probably be retired by now. And I never really got it, because I'm like, I'm just me. Like, I don't compare myself to other people. I don't. It's not a competition other than myself. Like, I have to prove myself every day that I'm good enough. So, you know, I became very successful at work, far surpassed any expectation I would ever have myself. I have a very good job, great career, have maintained friendships with those in the Army, and have a really proud, you know, kind of, I don't want to say storied, but I had a very, very good, hard experience in the Army, which really kind of gave me the motive, like gave me like the confidence that I could kind of go out and achieve things. That coupled with all the physical activities and races and stuff like that. So, and you know, my children grew up in a completely different household than what I grew up in, because there was no, like, we were very firm with them. And, you know, a couple of years ago, both my kids thanked my wife and I for raising not to be jerks. Like, they used another word, but they said, like, we never understood why you guys were so firm on us. Like, we'd go out places, you made us behave. And now we see like the product of kids not behaving. But guess what? Like, I never had to beat those kids. I never had to do the things my father did to me. And I could never really understand you know, if you love somebody, how you could hurt somebody so badly. And I almost kind of went on the other side of that. Not quite, but like enough that, you know, so, you know, everything was going pretty well, but my ADHD started getting a little out of control. And like, I always had this sense of foreboding and always like my mind never shuts down, you know? So I started finding, you know, recreational things that kind of like brought me down a little bit, you know, and not in an abusive way, but I didn't realize that I was really self-medicating, and that stuff's legal. So it's, you know, whatever, but you know, but alcohol never did it for me. I don't like to feel that out of control. But the other, you know, marijuana, like, gave me kind of like a sense of control and would allow me to be a little more introspective. I used to use it when I first played music because it allowed me to kind of like get that, like, I'll say like separation without checking out. So, you know, so I started doing that long after I was out of the Army, and it kind of got me to a place, but then I found myself kind of, I didn't realize it, but I was really becoming dependent on it. And while this is happening, a family member, and I don't know how much of this I can really get into because I don't want to tell somebody else's story, but the story impacts me, and it's the intersection of where we kind of met. So there was, you know, something had happened to my family when they were young and, you know, in high school, and we never realized it, never really were able to diagnose it or figure out what had happened. But it was, you know, it was a bad experience that resulted in PTSD to that family member. And, you know, and then COVID came, which I think has really opened people's eyes to a lot of what's going on with mental health. And like, and the thing I would always find is, and I find this with a lot of veterans who suffer from PTSD, some of my friends in particular. And what I discovered was that I didn't have PTSD from the Army. I deployed places. Like I was in, you know, was in real world conflicts, but it never anything that was so bad that it scarred me or anything like that. I mean, you know, I have dreams about schools I was in, you know, and still think that I'm there, which is a common phenomenon as well, I guess. But what I didn't realize was that I definitely had PTSD, and I had it from my childhood. And, you know, I think that kind of triggered, and I'm not a professional, but I'm pretty introspective, and I think that made my ADHD kind of go a little bit batty as well. I kept that all at bay for a pretty long time. And then with the COVID situation with my family member, things kind of went off the rails. And, you know, and it was, you know, with, you know, substance abuse and those sorts of things. And as frightened I'd ever been in my life from anything I've ever done, from jumping out of airplanes to being shot at, to having to come home to an abusive father or fight somebody in the street, you know, on a daily basis, nothing frightened me as much as when one of my family members was in such like mortal peril. And it got so bad, like, I didn't have control of things. I'm a bit of a control freak. I try to make sure that I've set all the conditions for what I'm going to do, to make sure that I can control the outcome. I don't like to be the victim. I never like to play the victim card. I never like to be in a position where my lack of preparation or lack of awareness would ever put me, like, get me caught out. So this was something I couldn't control. And as much as I thought I could, I couldn't. And there was some, you know, outside factors that were at play with the situation that was going on, other actors. And I found myself, like, my body broke out into hives. Like, I literally, like, I had to get to the point where I had to come to grips that I was probably going to lose this person. And part of me goes, well, that happens, I'm just going to check out. Like, you know, I can't live like that. But I actually had to make a deal with myself that if that were to happen, I knew that I did everything I could to control that. And that I had other family members, you know, my wife and all that loved me, cared about me. And I would be doing nobody any good by doing that. And it'd be extremely selfish. But didn't mean that, you know, that there wasn't that thought. Like, when things like that get so overwhelming. Mm-hmm. So it was at that point there, you know, I saw that I had to go to the unit where the family member was. I just see them. And I came back home, and I was on the way home, I was literally catatonic. And I was thinking to myself, like, how could I have missed this? How could I have screwed up so bad that I could not have, you know, and the fact of the matter is, there's no way, like, you know, you're in the field, you see it. And there's always like that guilt of like, how did I do this? So at that point there, I have a really good friend who works in mental health, and I spoke to her, and she put me in touch with a therapist. And, you know, and this sounds narcissistic maybe, but I was always like, I don't want to go to somebody. Like, if I went to like a personal trainer, I would never go to a personal trainer. Like, because I was like, you know what? I know how to do it. I would go to them, but like in most cases I would see them and I'd be like, no, they can't help me. And I've done the same thing about therapists. I'm like, listen, like I've dealt with a lot in my life. If somebody can teach me something, great, but you better come pretty big. You know, you better come with knowledge, and you better come, I mean, yeah. Like, you know what I'm saying? Like, and I don't mean to sound like a jerk. It's just, you know, like, I don't want to waste anybody's time. But I had enough faith in my friend, and she knew the deal. Like, she's known me for years. And so she goes, I have somebody good. She's semi-retired, but I think you ought to speak to her. And at the time, I had no other choice. I really did. I mean, I literally was broken out in hives. I was scratching myself. Like, I was, and that's when I realized that, like, mental health is, when it became a physical manifestation, I realized that, well, this is way bigger than what I'm capable of dealing with. So yeah, I better get somebody who can help me out here. You know, it's not like I'm trying to improve my bench press by 15 pounds or something. Like, this is like, no kidding. Like, got to get this sorted. So I did. And, you know, I just had surgery when this was going on. And banged up from that and having to deal with like the intervention and the protection and dealing with outside actors and all kind of craziness. But my therapist had said, look, would you consider taking, you know, some sort of medication? And I was like, absolutely not. Like, listen, I don't want to be dependent on something. I want to be resilient, and I should be able to figure this stuff out on my own. Like, you can give me coaching points, but then I kind of backed myself up and said, wait a second, I'm going to this lady who is a professional. I am not. And if she's suggesting this and I don't at least try it, then I am not, like, then what's the point of doing this? Like, you can't do it halfway. You can't like, go, okay, I want to listen about certain things I like and cherry pick that. So I said, okay, great. I'll get on the meds. And it really kind of hit me hard. And you know, she'd asked me like, what is your aversion to it? And I said, well, I want to be resilient. And she kept it mad real with me. And she said, listen, you just had surgery, right? And I was like, yeah. She goes, did you do it yourself? I was like, no, I didn't. I had a doctor do it. She goes, did you take pain meds? And I was like, well, of course I did. She goes, did that make you less resilient? I said, no, it made me more resilient because now I can go back to doing the activities I like doing and all that. She goes, same
yes,
thing.
Yes, I love yep. that. Yep. I love her. Yep.
So, you know, I did that, and I found that the meds, the first dose, kind of, it helped. It got, like, the hives went away. Like, I was able to get more sleep. And while this was going on, like, you know, with my marriage, I'm always the one that's always, like, kind of forging ahead. I'm always the one that's, like, pushing the envelope. My therapist will say, look, you're relentless. Like, you just keep going. And, you know, and I do, I can't help it. But my wife is like the type B, but she is like picking up the mess. So after I kick the door in and do the intervention, sort that out, and I could write a book on the intervention itself, you know, hacking a Snapchat account, you know, turning the tables on the person that was coming into our lives that needed to go away. And then coming to grips with the fact that I really, well, we'll get to this in a little bit. So that got me kind of on the right track, but then I noticed certain side effects and, you know, so me being me, you know, I was going on a work trip and then seeing a really good friend of mine from the Army who does suffer from PTSD and, you know, has been dealing with for 30 years. I just decided I was going to take myself off of the drug, and it was Lexapro. I was like, you know what? Like, I'll be okay. And, you know, so I get there and he's like, hey, you getting the brain zaps? He didn't admonish me. He's like, and I was like, you know, I am. And, you know, and when I was doing that, I had no more real desire to do anything else. Like, I didn't want to do, you know, any type of marijuana or alcohol because I felt kind of balanced, but like I gained weight. I had some other things going on with it. And I was like, you know what? I think it got me where I need to go. It cauterized the wound. Let's drive on.
I think we all get to a point, you know, in that when we were on meds where we're like, I'm good. I don't need this anymore. Yeah. Like, but it's a tough yeah. thing to push through. And just as a blanket yeah, statement you know, out there to everybody, don't ever take yourself off of your meds. Go to your doctor first.
Absolutely. From, I think from it's a little bit like
many people experience. Who have done it in the exactly. All three of us have had personal experience yes. and very bad ones yes. at that. Don't do
yeah.
it.
Don't do it. It's just, I mean, and the other thing too is that like you're not like the one thing I realized is you really don't know how those chemicals are going to react with you.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And they're a delicate balance. And the one thing, like, I'm always skeptical of big pharma. Like, I get it, right? But, like, I will say that, like, when you're prescribed, there's a little bit better predictability and supervision. Like, you can't say enough for the supervision that you require with that. You don't want to mix it with stuff. You don't want to do anything that's not, like, you know, it's like going out and tinkering with your car when you have no idea what you're doing. And, you know, so I took myself off of it. And then I kind of dealt with it. I went to my therapist, and we were in like thing we were doing like we kind of broke it down. Like I was through like a really bad part, so I was like maybe once a month or something then. And so you know, I went back to her and I told her. I said, "You're probably gonna be mad at me." And she goes, "First off, like I'm not mad at you for anything. I wouldn't recommend that, but you're okay." And I said, "You know what? I think And she goes, "Would you like to try something else?" She goes, "A lot of people like they'll try something, they'll take themselves off of it, and they're reluctant to get on anything else." And I was like, "Listen. You've already demonstrated like your capability with me. I get it. It just wasn't the right one for me. So absolutely." At the same time, my blood pressure was elevated, but only elevated when I went to the doctor's office. And, you know, and I had to drive on 228 to go see him, which is just a nightmare. And, you know, me being me, like I want to get there quick. I want to like drive efficiently. I want to like, you know, so by the time I get there, you know, like I check my blood pressure at home, it's, you know, 115 over 70. Like, it's not bad. I get there, it's like 160 over 100. And he's like, "We got a little problem here, you know?" So long story short, I found out it was from driving, because it would go right back down afterwards. Although, so he, you know, I had to go get all my, you know, readings on my blood pressure. You know, he calibrated it, made sure it was right, did it, it's fine. Go back from the next appointment, like 3 months later, it's even higher. And like, I'm feeling like lightheaded. And I'm like, "This is a problem." Go back home. And we figured out that it was me driving and a little bit of white coat syndrome and all that. And so the next time I said, well, I told my wife, I said, "You're going to drive me next time." And by this point I was on the first dose. I got into Celexa and I was on like 20 milligrams of Celexa, like half dose, whatever it was. And it brought me back down. So we drive over there. And my blood pressure in the doctor's office was like 110 over 70. And he looks at me and he said, like, this guy keeps it mad real too. He's like, "What the F did you do?" And I said, "Real simple. I had Audrey drive me here and I'm on Celexa." And he looked at me and he said, "You know what? You're never going to want to get off of that." He goes, "Because it's balancing you out in a way." And I said, "I was going to ask you, would I be able to up my dose? Because I feel like I'm almost there, but I'm still..." And he goes, "Absolutely." And then we had a chat, and this is what really made me think about it. This was back in like August of 2022. You know, we were talking and he said, "You know, it's so good to hear." And he's like a man, like he's a manly man, you know, like, I don't know if it's a bad thing these days or not, but whatever. But he's like a big dude. Like, he's somebody I can respect. Like, he reminds me of somebody that I knew in the army, you know? And he's like, "Look, man," he goes, "it's so good to hear." He goes, I'm on some of the same stuff. And he goes, "That's going to increase your life. Like, that's going to take such good, like, and there's no side effects with it. You can be on it for as long as you need." And he said, it's settling the chemical imbalances in your brain. We talked a little bit about my childhood. And he's like, "Yeah, that's the reason why you are the way you are." And he said, I wish I had, and I told him, like, kind of like I'm telling you guys, he goes, "I wish I had this recorded because I would play this for so many other male patients that yeah. I have, because so many men are so afraid to admit that there's, you know, a mental health issue." Especially like around like my age. I mean, I'm Gen X, like we're all like, you know, parents left us out in the streets by ourselves and we fended for ourselves and shot each other with pellet guns and, you know, all that stuff. You know, what I realized was back to the, you know, part about the, you know, the hives and all that's breaking out in the, you know, skin rash. was that there's a physical manifestation to what's going on mentally. And we talk about mental health, and then we talk about health, right? And I think at the end of the day, it's wellness and health. It's like, I don't see the bifurcation of the two. I think the two go hand in hand, because if you're not sleeping well, you're not going to be healthy. You're not going to be healing. And the other part of it was, there's not a lot that rattles me except for what happened to me, right? And like, there's a lot of people that are embarrassed to say, you know, yeah, hell yeah, I cry. Hell yeah, I have emotions. And you know what? If somebody wants to think that I'm a lesser, and again, this kind of dates me, Gen X, right? So bear with my genderism and masculinity or whatever it is, right? But I'm like, you know what? Like, screw you. Like, you know what? Like, you think I'm weak for doing this? No, I'm more resilient. You know what? I'll beat your ass. I don't care. Like, I'm not afraid of what you're going to say about me. I'm not. Like, I'm big enough to say, and you know, and it was one thing that we'd see in the Army too. Like, you would try to tough it out during certain times, but if you didn't take care of yourself, you didn't take care of your feet, you didn't take care of your equipment, you were going to be a liability to those around you. Yeah. And what I realized was that if I didn't fix myself, and I allowed myself to entertain, like going out and finding this person that was trying to come into our lives and take one of my loved ones away, and you know, and you know, it's classic, you know. It's classic mentality, right? Like I found the person, knew right where they were, and like, you know, and friends of mine were like, how didn't you kill them? You know? And I was like, well, because I did the calculus on it. And the calculus was this. This is what the results were. If I go and I do that, I'm going to jail. I'm losing my house, and he is not the problem. He is a symptom of the problem. And the problem is we need to be healthy and resilient at home. And so our family and myself taking the lead. And, you know, the family member said to me, like, you know, part of the struggle they had was that they always saw me as being like the toughest person they ever knew. And by seeing me in that frail state and getting help for it actually encouraged them, because they said, look, I'm not so weak, because if the old man can't deal with this, like, there's probably something to it. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of where that went. And so now, you know, I speak to my therapist every other week now. I actually increase the frequency because I'm finding that having that sounding board, and it's more like coaching sessions now. And because I constantly try to improve myself and be a better person, I'm finding that having that coaching and having that accountability, like I can't go away from that and be like, oh, you know, I'm not going to do that. Like, or, you know, I find myself, it's like having, you know, I go back to the personal training thing. It's like having a really good personal trainer, because there's accountability built in there, and they're outside of the fray of what's going on, and they can give you sound advice. So, you know, I never try to, you know, tell other people, hey, this is what you have to do or whatever, but I tell people, keep an open mind. And if you're struggling with things, don't look at it as being a weakness. The weakness is when you leave it untreated. It's like anything else. I mean, I'm very regular with my doctor checkups. I'm over 50, so manufacturer warranty is worn off. And, you know, like, you know, so I better stay on top of stuff. And the biggest thing with that is also staying on top of your you know, your total well-being. And I think that's part of it. So that's kind of like the background. Yeah. So I don't know if that was...
No, that's great. Thank you so much.
That's a great, wow, what a story.
And I just hear so many similarities. I'm like, yep, yep, me too. Yep, in the things that you're saying. Yeah. So that's what we try to do with these stories, is to have the people listening say, yes, me too. I'm not alone. There is
see
somebody
themselves.
Else. And be able to see, yes.
Yeah. Yeah. I think if it's, you know, if it's something, and I don't want to say normalize, like, you know, it's not like you want to foster like a state of victimhood. But like it is not like we're all human. We all have these things that happen, and you can never really understand how those are going to impact you, especially at a young age as I was. I mean, you know, from the time I grew up, you know, like, I mean, just unspeakable things that happened in my house. And you think that you get beyond it, but it leaves an indelible imprint, you know, dreams, manifestations in your personality. And I'll say that, like, my brothers and I have all, like, we've all been married like 30 some years each. Like, we've all kind of overcome that, which is you know, probably one of the things I'm proudest about, that we were able to kind of turn the cycle, like turn that, you know, break that cycle, break that chain of abuse.
Yep.
But it doesn't come without a cost. And the thing of it is, though, it's like, you know, no more than anything else. Like, you need to get surgery, you go and get it sorted out.
Yeah.
You need to get, you know, you need to get some help. You're making yourself a stronger person by doing it. It's not, it takes a stronger person to realize their weakness than it does for somebody to try to fake it and cause, and you know, and there's typically a knock-on effect of those around you. Like, there's going to be some cost to that.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So I find myself now not like, you know, I've never laid hands on my children. My wife never would, but you know, oh, I have a temper, you know, like I would snap, like everybody knew when Dad was mad. Mm-hmm. And by doing that, you know, it, you're not as in control. And so by getting yourself under control and being able to separate those emotions, understand where they're coming from, you can then kind of set yourself on a course correct.
So I have kind of a, this may sound like common sense to everyone else, so please forgive me if I'm coming across sounding really not intelligent by asking this. Again, child of the 80s, I'm probably about 10 years younger than you. So I was spanked. I got the belt. Like, I had that, but I was not, was not abused though. Like, I wasn't, you know, I mean, we can call that what it is, but it's not the level of what you went through at all. But what I will say is, like, that was how I knew what parenting was. So if there hadn't been this whole kind of revolution of like people being like, we don't spank kids anymore, I probably would have spanked my kids. Like, I'm going to be totally honest, because that's what I grew up with and was like, well, that's how I was disciplined. That's how you tell a kid not to do something. And it was just sort of like the outside influences of me being like, oh yeah, that makes sense. That's not the best way. I shouldn't do that. And so when I had children of my own, I didn't do that. So I guess, I don't know how to ask this. Like, how do you not like follow the same patterns as a parent? Mm-hmm. Like, I see that there's like, you know, cause people will say, well, hurt people. And if you grew up abused, you're likely to abuse. Like, how do you break that cycle, I guess, is my big.
Was it like sheer will?
Right.
Like, that you wanted to break the cycle?
I like to think I'm a pretty empathetic person. And there's nothing. My son got spanked twice. He got spanked when he was 4. Because he hurt my daughter and he lied about it. But it wasn't like pull your pants down and hit you with the strap until like your butt cheeks bleed.
Right.
It was like a quick pop on the butt and it was like, don't do that ever again. And it was more of the shock of doing it. And then one other time, and it was more of like, you know, it wasn't a beating. It wasn't like a, you know, and both of those got his attention very quickly. I found it better to kind of, and I won't say reason because I don't negotiate. Like, you know, like I'm going to tell you, like I'm telling them, listen, we're going to go someplace and I'm going to do everything I can for you, everything within our means. But if I tell you no, no means no. And if you challenge that, we're going to frog march you out of here and then all the fun stops. And you're going to go to your room and you're going to sit there and it'll be on you. So I'd give them choices, but it wasn't like a choice like that they'd get over on you with. I think but back to your point about what broke it was, I couldn't imagine hurting my children the way that I was hurt and the fear that I would have. My mother still has nightmares about it. I don't, because I kind of overcame it to the point and I saw him as being the weak person that he was, even though he was physically intimidating. I kind of overcame that when I went to the Army and I realized that, and I had a pretty good relationship. I was an officer. I had a really good relationship with my soldiers. And the thing I would do with them is I would never do something that I wouldn't do myself. I would lead by example. And I knew that it was better to encourage and to coach than it was to under threat of punishment. Like most people want to do good. Most people don't want to do bad. You make mistakes. Like what are you going to correct by beating somebody? Mm-hmm. And it's not to say that like if I had to do it, I would do it. But like it was almost like I would see with my dad and later when he was with my stepmom, that there was almost, I hate to say it, but it was almost like there was like some sort of sadistic pleasure in it.
Yeah.
And I think because he had been like adopted and was kind of kicked around a bit, he had a very loving father, like stepfather, but I don't know. Like, I don't know if there was just something, you know, I think a lot of it was undiagnosed. He was like classic signs of narcissism. I just never wanted to be like that. And like, I swore I would never hit my wife. Like, I would never, like, and look, have I been a great guy all the time? No, we've all made mistakes. But would I ever take her? Like, that is the person that I treasure and cherish. My son, my kids, my wife. Why would I ever abuse them? Why would I ever hit them? What is that going to accomplish? All it's going to accomplish is, I mean, when I was in high school, I wished my father dead. Like, I wished him dead. Yeah. Because, like, I was like, well, then this punishment stops. And so I never wanted to be viewed that way. And my grandfather, his stepfather, was the sign of, like, we were just talking about them the other day because I was out with my aunts, after a church mass that they went to for my grandmother. And, he came with such a loving personality. And I could do a podcast on this at some point, but probably won't. But like, just the way that he kind of fostered, like, I respected him more as my father growing up. And my dad was kind of here and there and out running around. And my grandfather would come over all the time. We didn't have any money, like, and he would bring over groceries. He's like, hey, a friend of mine gave me this, like, ham. Here you go. Like, there was no friend, like, he would just come over out of the goodness of his heart and would take care of us, so much so that I would call him Pappy. And my dad would get really upset, and he'd be like, I'm your Pappy. Like, no, you're not. Like, you're a dude that lives with us that beats the hell out of me. And I hate to throw, I hate to speak ill of anybody. But it was, it's what it was. And actually, my therapist helped me with that, because I then, after he passed, I didn't grieve. I didn't mourn him. And it happened only a few years ago. And, I felt as though, like, I was damning him to hell by not mourning him, not grieving him. And it gave me another complex, right? Like, it was. And so I talked to my therapist about that. And she said, listen, we all make our own choices. Mm-hmm. And this was one thing that my doctor told me as well, that was that I talked to her that day on a Sunday when I usually speak to her, and she basically told me it was okay to forgive myself for that. And I had like a rush of like almost euphoria, to the point where I was queasy, because it was like such a weight was lifted. And all the things, as much as he did all those things to us, he's still your dad. You still love him. Yeah. And the human side of me goes, like, if I don't grieve, or I don't, like, then I'm like, that to me is like where hell is when you're forgotten and all that. But as she had told me, she said, like, we all make our own choices, and he made his, and his resulted in a lot of pain to those around him. And you don't have to feel bad about not feeling bad about that. Exactly, and yeah. It was the biggest weight ever lifted off me. So that's kind of where that is. So I know I kind of went on about that for a bit.
No. I mean, I understand the weight that permission can lift for you. It's a huge thing.
Yeah. That's a good way of putting it. I never thought about it that way, but it's like, she gave me permission not to beat myself up about it.
We don't need to go here, but I'm so curious. I wonder what your grandfather thought of his son. Like, imagine watching your kid be like a total asshole. Like, oh man, I don't know.
Complete disappointment. Well, I'll tell you this. Okay. Maybe if this gets too much, stop. No, but so my grandfather died when I was 9 years old. And I grew up in the Catholic Church, and in the Catholic Church I grew up in, I found out a few weeks ago, because I reconnected with a kid that I grew up with, and the church we were in, the only priest that was there that seemed to be a good guy, that seemed to be a safe person, wound up being a serial molester, and it resulted in the suicide deaths of 7 kids I grew up with.
Oh my God.
4 of them I knew, like, well, and I didn't know about it. I knew about one of them. I knew about another that I knew died like a few years ago. I mean, these guys are in their 40s and 50s, 40s probably, when these events transpired. But like, so that was the kind of like where I grew up. Like, luckily I wasn't an older boy. I never dealt with him. My brother was, but never had the issue with him. So my grandfather died, and that was like my last vestige of like paternal, like that was a safe space for me. And my grandmother was okay, but my grandfather, like, I was, it was magical. And when he died, I was devastated. I was 10 years old, and every year I would, I would dream about him. And he would come to me in the dreams. We'd go hang out, and then he'd leave, and I'd cry, you know? And this continued on until I got into the Army. It got to the point where I went to airborne school in the Army, which he was a paratrooper in World War II, was a complete badass. And so, you know, there was an event there that happened that made me think of him pretty significantly. And it was almost like he was there with me in the way that it happened. And it kind of soothed me out as I was getting ready to make my first jump, which is, you know, you think it's kind of funny and all that until you get there. And then you're like, oh, yeah, shit, like, this is real. This is real, yeah. Right? Like, you know, and I mean, subsequent jumps along after, I mean, I'd be half asleep in my harness because I'd be so tired, like whatever. But the first one is like the shit gets pretty real right there. And so so I had a dream. You know, I got my scholarship to for my last 2 years of school. I was going to be an Army officer. I was out of the hood. You know, I was going to be successful in some regard, far more than I would have ever thought just by doing that. Right. Like, you know, and so I dreamt of him again. And in the dream, he's in the aircraft with me. And he's like, okay, son, time to go. We both jump out of the plane together. And then we kind of wind up in space. And it's kind of like at the end of Mork and Mindy, where like Mork's standing there talking to, you know, man in charge. And my grandfather's there with like these white robes on. And, you know, he's like, okay, like I've got to get going now. And I said, where are you? Are you with God? Because I had a lot of like questions about Catholicism, and I kind of checked out, and I would probably qualify myself as a hopeful agnostic.
Yeah.
But like, I believe in spirituality. So I said to him, I said, you know, where are you, Pappy? Are you with God? Are you in heaven? Like, where are you going? And he said, it's not how you think. And religion isn't what we all make it out to be. Religion is not the end state. Religion is merely a path. And I'm paraphrasing this now, but he said, but if you follow like what Jesus Christ would teach you, and again, I'm a hopeful agnostic, right? So I'm not going to preach any religion here. He said, but if you follow that, those principles and those type of mores, you'll get to where I am, and it's a really good place. And with that, son, he said, all you have to do is be kind to your fellow traveler. Be kind to your fellow traveler, and that's all that matters. And he said, with that, son, it's time for me to go. And that was it. No more dreams.
Oh my gosh. I have full goosebumps.
Same. Yeah. I was just going to say that.
So now we have the family. We have the family motto now, which is be kind to your fellow traveler.
I love that.
So if you ask me how I broke the chain, that's kind of it. I think that's it. I think it was his influence and seeing, like, emulating him, trying to be more Christ-like. Like, and I say that like as a, you know, like not in a secular manner, right? But like, be caring, be empathetic, be good to people. And look, I can just as easily knock somebody across their mouth as I can. But like, it's never like, I don't go, like, I try to be kind to other people all the time. And when in doubt, I try to be that person. I don't always succeed, but you know, that's the goal. Sometimes a stretch goal, but it's the goal, right?
Yes. Oh, I hear that.
Yeah, sometimes stretch a little more than others, right, but you know. Right.
So learning about your personality, I am wondering, my question is, from therapy, from taking this kind of turn and pivot in your life because of this significant event, how do you feel like you've changed as a person just in general? Like, how do you feel the shift has been in your daily life or maybe in how you handle certain things that come up?
Much better. I don't want to fight everybody. Mm-hmm. Not everything is a, I mean, not that I ever did, like, but like, I would take slights against me. Like, I was bullied incessantly as a kid. So my biggest thing is I hate bullies. And if I see somebody trying to bully or take advantage of me, I have the capability not to have to deal with that anymore. But I don't let those things really wear me out as much as they used to. I'm still a work in progress, as I think we all are. But I can say I can approach things with a little more clarity. I can control my impulses towards maybe being a little bit more aggressive. It's almost like I'm able to practice a little bit more mental judo when I come across a conflict situation. And I really don't let the small shit bother me anymore. I don't. I mean, I drive a little crazy at times, but very efficiently and very...
I love how you say efficiently. Yeah. It kills me every time. I love it so much.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's probably, I think that's really the only time my wife and I get into an argument is when we're driving, just cause like, I probably, you know, she, anyways, but yeah, I mean, I really, it's really kind of helped me out. I mean, so, you know, I'm in this band, right? So you know, here's probably a really great example. You know, we were playing out at a big venue that we're playing at this Friday, and we've gone from being like, we couldn't get paid for a gig for the first year that we played. We're on year two now, and we're now headlining some of the biggest places in Pittsburgh.
That's amazing. You guys are so good.
Jurgles and Warrendale. So I'll plug that. We're at Jurgles and Warrendale. Today I spent in a recording studio, took a day off for work so we could go do that. My daughter and I are both recording songs, our originals. You heard like the first inception of a couple of those when we met in April. But we were dealing with another band. We were opening for them. And a lot of times these bands will treat you like garbage. They see you as being like, you're the opening act. They treat you like shit, you know? So we had one band that like we opened for, and we brought a big crowd. And they were like, well, we didn't have this kind of crowd before. We need to use you guys more. And we made like $400 for like selling like over 100 tickets and really hustling our butts off. They were upset because the last time they made $1,000 less. And we were like, listen, don't cry to us about that. Like, you know, you want, so if you made $1,000 less, you're still making a couple $1,000, right? $2,000. So we, you know, they wanted us to open again. I said, well, look, we're not going to open. We'll co-headline with you. We have our own headlines now. Like, but we would co-headline with you. And, you know, I made a recommendation that they, you know, that they, well, whatever, it doesn't really matter. But so we get there, and they didn't hold their side of the agreement. They were late. They were intentionally late so that we wouldn't get a sound check. They wouldn't share their back line with us. We got there an hour early because I knew it was coming, right? Like, I knew it was going to be nonsense. And the event staff there were like, it's exactly how we thought it would be because these people were not good people. And so, you know, I was cool. And I just said, look, we're never going to deal with you again. And that's fine. We're going to get through tonight. We're going to be professional. But at 4 o'clock, when we were supposed to do our sound check, and the guy was just setting up his drums and waiting for the other five members of his band to show, I just went and pulled out a high top chair in the middle of the dance floor, right in front of the stage, and I just watched him as he did it. And so I didn't make any threatening comments to him. I didn't do anything, but I just sat there and just kind of watched him. And the manager out there, he's like, look, like, we all know you to be like the nicest, most professional person we know. We know that they're jerks, and the way that you dealt with that was just priceless. And like, I wasn't upset. I wasn't stewing. I was like, I win. And that night, like, they'll never be back. Like, as soon as we played our set, everybody emptied out. It was great. But yeah, so how am I reacting to things better? Like, before, I'd have probably wanted to grab him and put him in a headlock or a chokehold. And I wouldn't have done it because I don't want to be arrested. Like, it's not on my, you know, that's my goal in life, is never go to jail. I've made it this far. So, you know, but like, I'm not going to take that shit. You know, like, I'm just, the guy was being a bully. They were bullying my band members. They went to the meekest person in our band and started giving him a hard time. And I'm like, you know, that's how I, like, in the past, I'd have probably had words. I'd have probably told him to step outside and discuss this in more detail. But this case here, I just sat there and I looked at him. And that did way more. You know, and a good friend of mine that I was in the Army with too, that I still work with, he said, you know, like, he or she who angers you controls you. And I used to say it, but I never really lived it. Now I've become pretty good about living it, you know, and that's the big change.
That's amazing. That's a life lesson I think that is still seeping in for me. And that I'm trying to pass along to my kids, but I'm like, I know that right now at this age, you're like, shut up, mom. Like, you know, like, yeah. They don't want to hear that at all, but I'm like, don't let them have the power over you. Like, that's giving them power. Yeah. Is letting them make you upset.
Yeah, I mean, now on that same note, like, my mother told me when I was like 11 years old, my brothers were like 7 and 8, they're like, go down the street, you don't come home until you have blood. Like, your brother got jumped, you go down and you take care of business. And we did, right? Oh, yeah. Yeah, my mom's a badass. She just gave us eggs and tomatoes to go, like, egg and tomato people's houses and gave my grandmother a hard time down the street, stuff like that. So, like, vendetta and, like, revenge is, like, right through my life.
I cannot believe, like, how much you have risen above. Like, to hear the way you were brought up and to know, like, how you are now and how you handle things, like, that has to be so, like you just said, it's ingrained in your, like, fiber of how you were raised. Like,
oh, yeah.
I'm just so astounded. Yeah. I guess, like, this is what, where it's like, I hear these stories, especially of, like, you know, when I listen to true crime and things, and they're like, well, you know, the way they were raised and this is what happened to them, and I'm like, oh, no, because I know of people like you and other people that we've talked to on this show that I'm like, no, there's no excuse. You make the choices.
There's no excuse. There's no excuse. And it's in by playing that victim card And by allowing yourself, like, hey, look, like, when I found out, like, I literally, like, I hacked Snapchat. I found out who this person was. Facial recognition, got his identification, knew exactly where he was, who he was, and what he was up to. And I actually spoke to him as the family member on Snapchat and told him to get lost. And a couple other words, you know. But, like, you know, like it was her, or, you know, whoever. And that sorted that out. And, you know, back to my, you know, vendetta, like, you know, like going down the street and beating up kids that beat up your brother. I mean, nothing is more, I mean, they make movies about this stuff. Like, you know, somebody harms somebody's, you know, child, and, you know, you're going full, like, you know, Denzel Washington on his ass, right? And, like, you know, and not only am I ingrained that way, I'm pretty goddamn capable, you know, yeah, like, right. But, like, the part of it was, though, was, like, I realized, and a good friend of mine, very successful attorney, said, like, you know, Eric, how did you kill this person? And I said, let me step you through it.
Yeah.
And because if I do that, if I give into that urge, I give in that impulse, then everything I've created for the last 55 years goes away, and I can't protect my family. So I think that kind of goes over into what you're saying, too, about, like, we're all responsible for our actions. And because somebody treats you that way doesn't give you the right, and there's more honor and there's more strength, you know, it's stronger people that have more empathy. Mm-hmm. It is those that can take care of other people. It's weak people that hurt other people. Yep. It's weak people that take advantage of other people. And I never want to be viewed as weak. And I have weaknesses and I've demonstrated them throughout my life, but I always attempt to overcome that and try to be a better person, try to be the shepherd, almost like the, you know, Samuel L. Jackson, trying real hard to be a shepherd. You know, so, you know, and I'm still a work in progress. Look, man, I'm not, like, nowhere near, you know, but I found a few life hacks. I found a few things through, and it all comes down to mental health. Like, it comes down to how you kind of treat things that you didn't even know were diagnosed, and having the courage to have them diagnosed, and having the courage to listen to people that know better than you do, even if you don't think that they will, and giving it a chance. And, yeah, now you got me tearing up.
Aww. I almost said I'm sorry, and I stopped myself. I'm not sorry. It's good.
Yeah.
Feel it. Let it go.
Yeah.
Sarah and I just both got shirts that says "Feel the feelings."
Feel your feelings.
Feel your feelings.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah. Embrace that shit.
Yes.
Yeah. Two things I think that are really important. One is weakness, and the other is a victim. And I think that those two things are the opposite of getting help, right? And I think that's what you're telling us.
That's right.
And so,
that's right. Absolutely.
It's so important to know that, like, when you say, I need help, or I'm going to reach out, or that is not playing the victim at all. That no. Usually, you know, when you find yourself, like, either just not doing that and just complaining and whatever, or going down into your hole, or trying to get revenge, all of those things, that's more so that, you know? And so I think what you've shown us is how strong that is and how much that is the opposite, you know, of being the victim in a situation, in all situations.
Absolutely. And I'm a pretty pragmatic person. So, you know, what I saw is, like, and I typically don't complain. I will complain as a way to just kind of mark time until I come up with a solution. But, like, it's usually a very short time. It takes me just a while I kind of get my OODA loop working. And then I go, okay, this is it. Now it's time to stop complaining. And I was telling my therapist this last week. She's like, you know, saying something like, well, do you have to get yourself psyched up to do certain things? Like, be it, like, physical events, or, like, you know, getting up on stage and playing guitar or doing something difficult. And I said, no, what I do is, and there's no question whether I'm going to do it or not. I might not succeed in it, but I'm going to do it. But what I do do is, what I do is I give myself, like, a brief moment to grieve that. Like, I give myself just a minute to kind of feel sorry for myself. Yeah. And I say, okay, the moment's over, get it on, let's go, let's strap on and go, you know? So it's, but the weakness there, to your point, like, if you don't find help, like, you can't do it by yourself. You can't, like, you're not a doctor. You're not a carpenter. You can't do all that stuff. We're a society. And really found it in the Army, like, the weak links that you would have, if you could identify their weakness and help them out through it, they weren't weak, because next thing you know, if they run their feet off and you have to carry their rucksack and their equipment because they can't move anymore, they can't do things, then you're slowing down the whole unit. I mean, there's stories I could tell you about that, but I don't want to belabor it too long, but, you know, Like I would have people that I'd take people on runs every week. When it was, I would do officers PT. I would do my platoon leader PT. And usually platoon leaders didn't run PT, like physical training, like the NCOs would do. But one day a week I did it. And I'm like, if I'm going with these people, they're going to be up to, you know, I want them to a standard. So we'd go run, and running is where you could really kind of lengthen that suffering and really make people gut it up and make sure that people are pulling each other through. And so what I started doing was people would start to fall out of these runs. And I said, okay, we're going to put a stop to that. And so I just took two Polis litters, which are basically canvas bags with straps, gave the two different people and said, okay, when somebody falls out, they get assessed the casualty and we carry them until they get their mind right. And what it did was it had everybody pull each other along. It had everybody like, because it sucks so bad having to carry somebody. But at the end of the day, like if you don't get help, you're going to be the person getting carried. If I didn't get help and I checked out in whatever way that would be, I wasn't helping the situation by trying to tough it out. And so I would say to anybody, if you're trying to tough it out, the only thing you're doing is kidding yourself and putting yourself and others at risk. And nobody wants that. So go get the help. Go listen to people. They tell you to try and then try. It doesn't have to work for you at first, but find something that kind of gets you where you need to be, because otherwise you're a liability to you and especially to those around you. And that's kind of it.
Thank you.
Perfect.
So, yeah, it's perfect.
That was so good.
Thank you so much for taking the time, first of all, and second, willing to be so open.
Yeah, I'm honored to be here.
Yeah, being so willing to be open and vulnerable with us and just opening up with your story, it's really going to help others to feel less alone, to see themselves in you, and to know, to hear these lessons from you. I mean, I love having these conversations because I feel rejuvenated and I feel, you know, I get a little dose of something from everybody. So thank you for your unqualified therapist's opinion for us.
Yeah.
We really appreciate it.
Thank you so much. I was so moved by what you guys were doing when I met you, you know, at the Jagoffs, that I was like, boy, like, you know, if I can help them, if I can help out anybody by just sharing some, and I'm not saying what I've done is right or anything like that, but it's another perspective.
And, it is.
You know, absolutely. And if you feel like you're being weak by doing it, well, you're being weak by not doing it. You're being weak in the liability by not getting the assistance that you need.
Yeah. Preach.
Well said.
Great.
Thank you so much, Eric. We really appreciate it.
Absolutely.
And now here's the latest original, Max and Ruby, from Eric's band, Altered Egos.
The sky is getting dark and the air is cold, but I feel the fire in my soul begin to grow. Society's made me feel like I'm alone, seeping into my skin, all the way to the bone. They made me feel like I've lost all of my strength, but the truth is that I'm not that easy to break.
This episode was brought to you by Sarah Simone and Amy Baumgartner. Theme song and other music provided by Epidemic Sound. All episodes are mixed, mastered, and produced by me, Sarah Simone. To help us keep making episodes just like this one, consider supporting us on patreon.com/unqualifiedtherapistsinc. Or share us with a friend, relative, coworker, hairstylist, butcher, baker, candlestick maker. Sharing us not only helps keep the mics on, but it furthers our mission in removing the stigma. If you have a mental health journey you'd like to share, email us at unqualifiedtherapists@gmail.com or reach out to us on our website, www.unqualifiedtherapists.com. Until next time, hold on, warrior. We're gonna make it.